Couple remarks yet to make about Abraham. After defining faith in the first couple of verses, first three verses of the chapter, the writer goes on and begins to cite, refer to certain men who possessed extraordinary faith. And again, some familiarity with their lives, their life stories from the books in the Bible where they're given in detail would be worthwhile. Coming to Hebrews chapter 11, the author assumes some prior knowledge of these men. He doesn't retell everything about their lives, but he makes reference to something, and that thing that he points out ought to be understood in the context. When it says Abraham, you know, did something, then, you know, that should trigger some memories about everything that you know about Abraham in that life. But we've seen Abel as faith-worshipping, and Enoch as faith-walking, and Noah as faith-working, and the patriarchs, which would be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Joseph and his brethren, as faith-waiting. And because waiting really does seem to be part of the faith experience of each of these folks. Abraham, Sarah waited, of course, for a son. Isaac waited for a bride and waited for a son and looked. These people all looked for that inheritance to come through. Jacob waiting for Rachel, for example, you know, working those 7 years. And we said there's several things about Abraham's faith. In verse 8, we saw he had faith to leave. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. And again, sometimes, as a matter of fact, I should say every time you act in faith, there's going to be something that you don't understand about what you're doing. You don't have to be completely in the dark about the whole thing, but you don't need to completely understand the whole thing. If you completely understand, if you got all the details worked out and you got the thing, everything planned to the last item, you probably aren't working in faith. You're probably operating according to natural wisdom. And again, if I can say this at this point, I don't know if I've said it since we started on faith, but I need to say it somewhere in here, and I've said it other times, but let me say it somewhere in here in the study on faith, and that is unbelief is the cause of just about every problem you have. I mean, really, if you want to track it down and say, where did this thing start? You know, I got a problem here. Where did the problem start? One word, unbelief. Marital problems, unbelief. Child-rearing problems, unbelief. Financial problems, unbelief. Sin problems, life-addicting behavior, you know, life-dominating sins, unbelief. Unbelief, 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 unbelief. And unbelief is saying that God can't take care of this. I got to make sure I get it. I got to make sure I figure out a way to get it done. And acting in unbelief is to pretty much tie God's hands in doing anything for you. And stepping out in faith is saying if it's going to happen, it's going to have to be God that pulls through here. There's unknown things, and there's unknown, you know, unanswered questions, and if this is going to work, God's going to have to come through. And unbelief says, well, you can't do that because, you know, you'll never be able to make a living if you do that. You know, you'll starve to death if you do that. And so that's unbelief. And now God might direct you to go to a state college under certain circumstances. Under certain circumstances, he might. But you better be going because you know God told you, not because you're going in unbelief because you don't think that you'll be able to survive. You'll have to live in poverty the rest of your life if you go to a Christian college. I mean, if that's your reason for not going to a Christian college because you think you're going to live in poverty the rest of your life if you do, then you're acting in unbelief. Now, if you're going and say, I really believe God, this is where God wants me to go, and I prayed about it, and I'm sure about it, and he's given me the answer, and I can, you know, I can save my own heart without deceiving myself or kidding myself, this is where God wants me to go, then I'm all for it, see. But if the motivation is something that is unbelieving at its heart, then that's going to cause problems, not solve them. And you might be able to make a living, see, but what are you going to lose in terms of the other side, not just this side? This isn't all we have to live for. Anyway, faith to leave. Faith to wait. There's in verse number 9. By faith, Abraham sojourned in a land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Faith to wait. Sojourning in a land of promise, but hadn't found that city yet and hadn't gotten the title yet. Faith to search. By faith, he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Faith to receive, verse 11. Through faith, Sarah also received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. And again, I don't see a great deal of faith here in Sarah receiving strength to conceive seed. When she first heard about it, she laughed. Oh, yeah, right. Sure. You know, and that was, I mean, she wasn't laughing with joy, because she was rebuked for laughing. Now, if the angel hadn't rebuked her, then, you know, maybe you could allow for she's just overjoyed. But the angel rebuked her. So we know she was laughing kind of cynically, sarcastically. And so there's unbelief there. But, you know, the amazing thing about faith is faith is dependent upon its object, not its quantity, not its strength. You say, how much more did Abraham believe God than Sarah? I don't know. I think he probably believed God more than Sarah believed God. I think Abraham believed God, but I don't think either one of them believed God a whole bunch in this matter, or that whole thing with Hagar would have never happened. But they believed God at least enough to say, you know, well, Lord probably can do it. Whether he really is going to come through or not, I don't know. I've never seen anything like that before. But, you know, to say, all right, I believe you, God. How much? Just enough to barely say it, you know. But is that faith or isn't it? You know, and it's not talking about, you know, absolute, unquestioning faith that had complete, total confidence that everything was going to come out just like God said. And, you know, but no, it was for trusting God to enough degree to where he can act. And so faith to receive. In faith, you wait, you believe, then you wait, and you eventually see. Unbelief says, I'll wait and see. Unbelief says, I'll wait and see. Faith says, I'll wait and see. You know what I'm saying? I believe it when I unbelief, I'll believe it when I see it. Faith, I believe it, I'll wait, and then I'll see it. And then faith to sacrifice, and this is the last couple things about Abraham. Verse 12 is just commentary on what happened. Therefore sprang there even of one, Abraham, and him as good as dead, and when it comes to that part of life. So many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. And again, most of the time I think that the stars are a reference to a spiritual seed, and that the sand is a reference to a physical seed, and we're part of that spiritual seed. But the original spiritual seed was those in Israel that were believers, not just Israel according to the flesh, but those that were Israel according to faith, like Abraham had. And those wild branches, the ones that didn't have faith, cut off so us, or the natural branches, the olive tree, cut off so us wild branches could be grafted in. And we're like the stars. But the sand of the sea would be the physical seed of Israel, and the stars of heaven be the spiritual seed. And I don't know if Abraham understood that distinction, but he didn't have the book of Hebrews and other things to explain all that either. But whatever he knew he was going to have offspring more than he could count anyway. And that's eventually what happened. But he never saw it. He saw Isaac. He never even got to see. I don't know. Maybe he did. Was Abraham still alive when Jacob and Esau were born? I'm not really sure clear on that. I'd have to go back and check. But I'm under the impression Abraham was dead before those two boys were ever born. I think he saw Rebekah because he sent Eleazar to retrieve Rebekah. But I don't know if he even saw his grandchildren. So it came, nevertheless. He believed God, and it did, and didn't have to see it by anything other than trust and faith, because God could perform it after he was gone. And then we come to verse 17. I'm sorry. Well, I'm skipping something here. I'm skipping, verse 13 and 14. There's sort of a parenthetic statement, some stuff in there in verse 13 and 14 that is more of a general teaching. So I want to jump across to verse 17 and 18. Because we're still talking about Abraham here. And there, Abraham in verse 17 and 18 is faith to sacrifice. Again, everything in between is generally applied to all the patriarchs. But staying with Abraham, by faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he hath received him in a figure. And here's the amazing thing about what Abraham did here. Abraham committed absolutely to God, the only means by which God could fulfill his promise. I mean, unless God came up with another Isaac, this is the end of everything God said he was going to do. And again, as far as the Bible records, Abraham didn't revolt or have any indignation about it. He didn't hesitate. He didn't resist. There's no outrage. There's no disillusionment. There's no wrestling over this. And probably the most important thing of all, there's no delay. He didn't even put it off, stall, and try and, you know, get away with not doing it for a while. It was all done, the whole thing of taking Isaac up the next morning to the mountain and offering him was done in humble acceptance. And that son, Isaac, he was the son of promise. He was unique. He was irreplaceable. But if God could do it once, then I guess God can do it again. Now, we all know what happened when he got up there. God showed him a ram caught in a thicket. You know, God shall provide himself a ram for a sacrifice and all that. And so, you know, he didn't have to do it, but he had the knife poised to plunge. He was that close. And as far as Abraham was concerned, it was a done deal. Now again, that picture right there of Abraham up on that mountain with Isaac on the wood, I mean, spread out, tied down, the knife in his hand, that doesn't fit at all any kind of sterile or academic concept of faith. You know, I mean, some people's definition of faith, when you talk to them about their faith, you know what, or you knock on the door, hi, I'm from Bible Baptist Church, you know, and we're out knocking on doors in the area, and we'd like to know if you're looking for a church home, you know, we'd like to invite you to come visit our church. And also, if you've got a few minutes, I'd like to talk to you about how you can know where you're going to spend eternity. How the Bible says you can know for sure that you're going to heaven when you die. I'd like to show you if you've got a few minutes. And they say, you have your faith and I have my faith. Right? I already have my faith. Anybody ever use those exact words with you? You know, usually say my religion, but you know, if you say, "Well, if you were to respond with something like, well, do you really have faith?" I go to what? I mean, Our Lady of Perpetual Bingo. You know, okay, well, do you have faith in that church? You know, or St. Vegas the Night, you know, or whatever. But says I have faith that my church. Where's your faith? Where's your faith? Well, my faith. Tell me about your faith. Well, I just believe. To them, faith is some sort of a ritual, a recital of a creed on Sunday morning. You know, again, the ritualistic recital of meaningless words by bored congregants led by skeptical reverends and vicars. Creeds and doctrinal statements that never touch any life in any meaningful way. You know, I believe in the Holy Apostolic Church. I believe in the Father, Son, and Holy. You know, and it just, they mutter through it, but there's no passion to it. There's no vitality to it. There's no enthusiasm about it. And there's no comprehension of what the words even mean. You know, I could memorize something in Latin and not know a word of Latin, you know, but be able to get the right speech sounds out, but not have any idea what it was I was saying. The charismatics do that when they speak in tongues a lot of times. Seriously, you know, they just memorize a bunch of spiritual sounding words. You know, Salamanda, you know, Omae Connectai, you know, and they hear what other people, and then they string them all together, you know, and there's, how do you know you're not cussing in some dead language, anyway? You know, so, really, I mean, you know, some Mesopotamian language, you know, like the Tartars, you know, didn't they get exterminated, the Tartars? You know, some kind of Eurasian tribe over there, you know, the Huns wiped them out. So how do you know you're not cussing in Tartar when you go off on that stuff? You know, Salamahanda. Well, maybe that's a really bad word. Maybe I shouldn't say it myself. you know, but the Hostile Shandai, you know, it doesn't always start off with that one, but that one's in there a lot. You know, that's my faith. If a person's faith, let me tell you this, if a person's faith doesn't bring them to some kind of sacrifice, then it's not genuine. It's just the recital of a credo. And this is where faith is seen to be either real or imagined. And people can attend religious institutions and throw a little bit of money in the plate and recite credos, but that does not bring them to any kind of sacrifice. I say, well, sure, they sacrifice, you know, an hour out of Saturday night. to go there. Or they sacrifice an hour out of Sunday morning in order to go there. And that, I suppose that their faith then to that extent, yes. I don't call that big sacrifice, by the way. But understand, when you take your whole life and you put it on altar and you say, whatever it is you want me to do, God, I'll do that. I'll go wherever it is you want me to go. If you want me to be a missionary, if you want me to go to Papua New Guinea and me to go to Venezuela and live with a bunch of illiterate pagans, you know, and only be able to see another white face about once every 6 months when the missionary pilot comes through when his little pup, you know, Piper cub and drops off a box of groceries, and I'm going to have to eat beetles and cook my food over dung and all that sort of thing in order to reach it. If that's what you want me to do, I'll do that. See, now that's getting pretty real. You say, well, you know, what about the Jesuits and Dominicans, you know, and the mendicant orders during the Middle Ages? And well, I'll have to say this. They did sacrifice. Some of them sacrificed. And I won't take away the reality of their faith. I'm sad that it was in something that wouldn't save them. But, you know, at least they had enough reality to their faith where they made some sacrifice for it. You know, G.B. Vick once said, and this is back in the 50s, I think, that he said modern Christians aren't willing to be inconvenienced for Christ, let alone suffer for his sake. You know, I mean, really, what's the big sacrifice? Again, if those mendicant friars and the Dominicans and the Franciscans could make those kind of sacrifices during the Middle Ages, and some of them, you know, coming over here, and the same Venezuelan people, the same kind of primitive tribes that are there now. You understand they were there in the 17th century when Dominicans, Franciscans would go there and try and ecclesiasticize them, I guess. You know, try to civilize them, make Catholics out of them. Those guys, they couldn't come home on furlough every 3 years. Single men, a lot of them. I guess all of them. You know, but I mean, they didn't even have a wife to go along with them to share it. Just go by themselves. That's sacrifice. That's real. I'll give them that. You know, but when some growly face. You hear that Jeunesse commercial? I heard a commercial for Jeunesse by Chamonix tonight, you know. I've heard that commercial a lot. The first time I caught this one, the woman says, "It really. I put it on and it gave my face 5 to 10 years younger." Well, man, if you laid off the whiskey and the cigarettes, you know, maybe you wouldn't need the. Did you hear the next time the commercial's on, you know, and they have all these ladies telling about what it did for them?
I made my face look 5 to 10 years younger.
Oh, man. Yeah, have another lucky strike, you know. But anyway, what was I getting at? Real faith is willing to sacrifice. It'll put itself, its future, on the line for the thing that it believes in. And if they can do it for something that won't save them, that's something that's false, something that's empty, something that's just a lot of ritual, superstition, then why can't Christians? Why can't, you know, if you got something real down in here, you know, I mean, this is real. You think about that Franciscan monk who leaves everything familiar in Europe, leaves his monastery and leaves the cathedrals, you know, all those magnificent buildings, you know, and the impression that they make on you when you see them, leaves all that and goes and lives in a grass hut away from all the stained glass, away from all the silk robes and away from all the accoutrements of the papacy, you know, all the elegance, all the wealth and all that, and he stays there for the rest of his life and ministers to those people, and all he's got is just a memory of some cathedral back in Europe and one time that he got to visit the holy city. And that's what he bases his service for the rest of his life. And then we've got the Holy Spirit living inside of us and we can't sacrifice anything and we call it faith. Strange, isn't it? Now, Abraham brought it all up and put it all on the altar and said, here it is. God, if you want it, it's all up to you. You understand verse 18, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Up until this point in human history, nobody had ever been raised from the dead. I've never seen it. You've never seen it. No charismatic's ever done it. But we do have a Bible, and I mean, this book right here, you understand, I have staked my soul on a book. I mean, if this isn't it, I'm in big trouble. I didn't stake it on a pope. I didn't stake it on a cathedral. I didn't stake it on a church Christ founded or any other nonsense like that. I staked my eternal soul on a book. And when I mean this book right here, I mean this book right here. Amen. It's King James Bible. Anything disagrees with it, it's wrong. I stake my soul on this book right here. And I know that the Bible talks about Jesus raising dead people. Widow Aeneas' son, Jairus' daughter, Lazarus. I know about Elijah's bones being thrown on that, or was it Elisha? I think it was Elisha. But they threw his bones in that open grave and that guy came back to life. And I read about Elisha, I think it was Elisha, laying on the body of that woman's dead son and him coming back to life. I understand about the Bible teaching that some folks were raised from the dead. But Abraham didn't have all that. He couldn't read the New Testament to see how Jesus raised dead people. He didn't know about Elijah or Elisha, whichever one it was. I'm not straight on it right now. I think it was Elisha, but it could be wrong. But anyway, he never read those stories because they hadn't been written yet. But he is accounting, verse 19, that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence also he received him in figure. Now, again, it's hard for me to believe. Now, God told me, He said, "Now take Amy, go kill her, and I'll raise her up." It'd be hard for me to believe that. But if I ever heard of it happening to somebody, somewhere, sometime, it would be easier to believe it. But Abraham didn't even have that much to go on. First time in human history that anybody was even figuratively raised from the dead. Now, again, Isaac wasn't killed. But he would raise them in a figure. But as far as Abraham is concerned, again, the knife's going in. And so Abraham didn't have so much to fall back on as a few accounts in the Gospels of the Old Testament of somebody being raised from the dead. Just a promise. And a promise concerning something else that would require Isaac being raised. God didn't even tell him that I'm going to raise him from the dead. He just said, go offer him. And Isaac, go offer Isaac. And Abraham thinks to himself, well, God said he'd do this, and he said he'd do this, and he said do this, and he said do this. And he said he was going to do all those things through Isaac. So if he's going to do those things, then and I kill him, there's only got to be one way he can do that. He's going to have to raise him from the dead. I mean, because there's no other way it can happen. If Isaac's dead and gone, then these promises can't be fulfilled. And I know God keeps His word because I got Isaac in the first place. I know He knows how to do it, and I don't need to help Him. So as hard as it is, I'm going to go ahead with this. Natural wisdom had to be thrown aside. Everything that made sense, he didn't have a bunch of unbelieving relatives to talk about, why are you doing this and why are you doing that? And if you send them over there, they'll never get a job. They didn't have all that to contend with. But he had to scorn the counsel of the ungodly anyway. He couldn't get on the phone and call his best buddy and say, hey, I think God's telling me to do something. What do you think about it? Again, some whiskey drinking, cigarette sucking, TV watching, reprobate, never read the Bible or went to church, going to give you advice about decisions in your life concerning your children. I don't care if it's, I don't care if it's grandma and grandpa. I wouldn't take their advice. If they don't know God, they don't walk with God, they don't live for it. I wouldn't take their advice. What do they know? They're just mercifully surviving because God is, what we call common grace. He allows them to make a living because God's good to the just and to the unjust. And He lets rain fall on the cussing, drinking, fornicating farmers' crops just like He lets it fall on the Christian farmers' crops. But when it comes to the future of a Christian young person, I wouldn't take their advice. Natural wisdom had to be thrown aside, and the counsel of the ungodly had to be scorned. Why? And again, this is a matter concerning Abraham's son, see? He said, why are you bringing this whole thing about our children up? Because you and I, see, our faith is going to affect our children's decisions. If we succumb to unbelief, the future of our children might be negatively impacted by our unbelief. I want my children to do what God tells them to do. And, I'll be there to help if in any way I can, but also want them to do what God tells them to do. And if I can't carry anything more than a certain amount, then they need to trust God for the balance. what made good sense had to be forgotten. And God had to be the most real thing in the universe to Abraham for him to go through with this. But he did it. And 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9 says, "For this to this end also did I write, that I might know the proof of you, whether you be obedient in all things." That's the question. You know, are you obedient in all things? Well, I'm obedient in things that don't cost too much. I mean, I can come to church a couple times a week and tithe, and maybe even give a little bit to missions. Maybe even give a little bit to the building fund. That's I can handle that. I can even be a little bit of a weirdo in the world. I was a weirdo before I was saved, so I guess I can be a different kind of weirdo after I'm saved. You know, being a pariah and an outcast on one side, I'll just be a pariah on the other side, that's all. Just go to the opposite end of the spectrum and just go as far out on this side as I did on that side. You know, but real sacrifice. Putting it all on the altar, saying, "God, this is my life is yours. My children are yours. Everything is yours, and I just want your will to be done. That's all. That's all. And I'm trusting you to take care of what doesn't make sense, but if you're telling me to do it, I'll do it." And I made a couple of decisions in my life. Let me just say this. I'm not sure I was making the right decision, but I'm sure I thought I was. And I believe God will bless a decision that is made with sincere intentions. And I'm not saying I'm sure I was wrong. I'm just saying I'm not sure. I'm still not sure. But it came down to where I had to make a decision. And in the decision I made, I really believed I was making the decision that God wanted me to make. You say, "Well, what if you make the wrong decision?" I don't think God is really in the business of hiding his will from somebody that really wants to know it. You know, that just didn't... I know God better now than I did back then. You know, again, your ideas about God are based somewhat on your parents, and my dad's a jerk. I mean, really, you know, he's a self-absorbed, insensitive jerk. And so my idea of, you know, of God is kind of based on, you know, well, he's never there when I need him. if that's, you know, relative to my dad. And I know he saved me, but as far as all this provisional stuff and caring about me and being there when I need him, well, that's a completely different concept than anything I'm used to with regard to fathers. So, as a father, I can understand that part of God a lot better than I could before I was one. And so I'm kind of here, you know, and "God, do you want me in Pensacola or do you want me here in Greenville? Do you want me in Pensacola? I think you might want me in Pensacola, but you brought me to Greenville, but I would have never known about Pensacola if I hadn't been in Greenville." And every night in chapel they tell you if God sent you here, he sent you here to finish, and you're out of the will of God if you leave, but it seems like you're telling me different. But every time I go to chapel, they tell me God sent you here to finish, and you're out of the will of God if you leave. So, you know, I was really confused. I mean, I really was. It was every night in chapel. "God sent you here to finish. You are out of the will of God if you leave." That's what they teach you in chapel, in Christian schools. And so I heard that every night, and God said to me every day, "Leave this place. It's a good place, and thank God for it and what you learn here, but I want you to go someplace where they believe every single word in the Bible, not most of it, but every word of it. And I want you to, that's where I want you to go be trained, is down there in Pennsylvania." And so, you know, I mean, I really had to wrestle with it. And I came home from work early, and I put on my best suit. And it was in the summertime, but I put on my best suit, turned on the air conditioner in my bedroom, in my trailer, and got down beside my bed with a gallon of water and said, "I'm not leaving this room until I get the will of God." There I prayed, again, wearing my best suit, on my knees, on the tile floor, in an old rickety trailer, and begging God for direction. He gave me 7 verses. And I mean, completely out of context. Really, I mean, absolutely, utterly out of context. Couldn't be any further out of context. But those verses came up, you know, and each one of them seemed to be pointing in the same direction. And I wasn't, you know, I honestly wasn't looking for God to give me an excuse to go. I was looking for what God wanted me to do. And so I acted on that, you know, and I couldn't act it any differently. And I was pretty sure that I was in the will of God. Now, again, years later, I look back over and say, well, maybe I wasn't. You know, maybe I dreamed the whole thing, or, you know, maybe I interpreted those verses the way I wanted them to. What I wanted them to be saying is what I made them out to say. I can't say for certain about any of that, because if I'd have stayed in Greenville, you know, I met my wife in 1980, and I graduated from Pensacola, of course, in 1981. If I'd have stayed in Tabernacle, I would have graduated the same year. In the same year, I would have graduated from Tabernacle Baptist College. She was contemplating going back to Bob Jones for a master's degree. and I would have been in Greenville, and she would have been going to church at Tabernacle. I mean, that's where she would have gone to church. That's just where she would have gone. That was already settled. She was thinking, and so my last year, she would have been coming down to Greenville to get her master's degree. And so it was very conceivable we could have met, because I'd go over to Bob Jones, hang out in the library, try to meet girls. So, you know, so I mean, God, you know, but God used another way of bringing us together, you know, and sent Jim Lintz down there, and his wife Cheryl was the monitor in the ACE school, and my wife was the teacher, and so, you know, again, Cheryl set us up as a blind date. So, you know, I mean, God can work things out, can't he? And you know what I really think about the whole thing now is not whether, I'm not really so sure God wanted me in Pensacola rather than Greenville. You know what? I think God wanted me to do what he wanted me to do. I really do. I think that was what it was all about. It was all about what does God want me to do? And then, you know, I think as far as God was concerned, whichever I would have decided on was okay. He could have worked everything out. And I had all the commentaries. I didn't have all the commentaries, but I had some of the commentaries, and I was getting the Bible Believer's Bulletin. I could order tapes, you know, so it's not like I couldn't have any kind of Ruckman thing going on. So, you know, I'm just saying, the issue is sometimes where's your heart? Not where's your body. If your heart is completely surrendered and in the perfect will of God, then where your body is doesn't really matter. I could have my body in either place, see, and have done it on my own. Because I could have left my body in Greenville and said, no, God, I don't, you know, I'm just staying in Greenville. I don't care what you say, I'm staying in Greenville. Or I could have said, I'm going to Pensacola, God. I don't care what anybody else says about it. I'm going to Pensacola. And I could have had my body in either place out of the will of God. And the point was, I think at that stage in my life, the most important thing was not where was my body, but where was my heart. And God just put me through something to test my heart. And then he finally said, I think this kid's ready, you know, to get some kind of an answer. And so gave me peace when I left that room about where I was supposed to go. But again, looking back over it, having had more experience and more maturity, I don't really know that it was about which school. It was about my dedication, my surrender, my willingness to follow and obey and seek his will. Because it wasn't coming playing around. You know, I had to get down serious on my knees again, put on the get home from work, take a shower, put on my best suit, bring in a gallon of water, shut the door and say, I'm not getting up until God showed me something. And say, well, I don't know what God wants me to do. Well, you probably never have done much to find out either. You know? And then so you just do whatever it is that you decide you want to do, and then you might be in the will of God geographically, but you're not, again, your heart isn't there. And so God can't do for you what he'd like to do for you. And so the most important thing, again, in Abraham's case, is he just put his heart perfectly in the center of God's will and said, whatever it is that you want, that's okay with me, and I'm going to go ahead with it. Now, the next thing that comes up is exclusiveness of faith, and I took an extra couple of minutes on the other thing because if I started on that, I know it, I wouldn't have time to finish it. So we'll look at those verses, verse 13, 14, 15, and 16 in here next time. All right, let's be dismissed. And Brother Henning, maybe you close us in prayer. There is choir rehearsal, so if you're in the choir, if you could come up right away.